Okay, so I suppose we can start. And I want to continue with what we have been doing so far, which is like reflections on the Dhamma, how to contemplate the Dhamma, how to help us deal with defilements and these kind of things. And the first sutta here is really a sutta which is more about, if you like, death contemplation in a sense. It probably belonged together with the previous sutta on death contemplation, but anyway, this is where it has ended up, so we'll have a look at it here. And then after that, we'll have a look at the Ratapala Sutta, which has a very nice kind of summary about the Dhamma, summary which made this Venerable Ratapala go forth just by listening to this one brief summary here. Okay, so we will have a look at this and then see how that goes. The first sutta is called the Araka Sutta, found in the Anguttara Nikaya 7, and it goes as follows. Bhikkhus, in the past there was a teacher named Araka, the founder of a spiritual sect, one without lust for sensual pleasures. The teacher Araka had many hundreds of disciples, to whom he taught the Dhamma, such a Dhamma as this. Brahmins, short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So this is one of the places where the Buddha is talking, telling a story of the past. And the story of the past is this teacher, Araka. And this is obviously was a time when there was no Buddhism around. They were obviously ascetics, they were teachers, they were people who were practicing meditation, because one without lust for sensual pleasures really refers to somebody who has attained samadhi or the Brahma Viharas or something like that, whereby they have abandoned the hindrances. So that is the meaning. And this Araka, who lived in this distant past, he had many hundreds of disciples. And this was his Dhamma that he taught, right? Short is life, limited and fleeting. Just like we have been talking about, the death contemplation brings the reality of death into focus. Much suffering and much misery here. And when you understand this, then it means that your priorities get kind of sorted out, and you know what is important in life, and you do those things that matter, and you deprioritize those things that are not important. And this is the consequence of this kind of reflection, reflecting on death, essentially. So this sutta is basically about the teaching of this Araka, and this Araka, what he taught was this seven similes, the similes on the shortness of life. That is what is coming up here. So let's have a quick look at these similes. It won't take long. They're fairly straightforward, but they're also quite nice in a sense. Just as a drop of dew on the tip of a blade of grass will quickly vanish at sunrise and will not last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a drop of dew. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So I don't think that this simile, I think the only meaning here is just to show how quickly life goes by, right? Suddenly you are at the end of your life, and it's like this drop of water on the blade of grass. When the sun comes up in the morning, all the dew vanishes from the grass. It's so quick, happens before you have even noticed, and it's all gone. And I think that is quite a common experience for humanity. You come to the end of your life and you wonder, what happened? You know, where is it all gone? It just disappeared. It feels like yesterday I was 20 or whatever. And sometimes I have to admit it feels a bit like that. It feels like I was 20 yesterday, but actually it's quite a long time ago now since I was 20. More like 30 years ago or something. So it happens very fast, right? Suddenly you find yourself in a very different situation. And this is often very, we need to be reminded of this, that things in retrospect, it seems so fast. When you're in the middle of it, it seems so long, but in retrospect, wow, what happened to it all? It's often good to talk to people who are older than you and ask them about life. And often they will say precisely that, oh, it disappeared, it happened so quickly, it's all gone. And that's exactly the point he's trying to drive home here by this dew on the tip of a blade of grass. Okay, next one. Just as when thick drops of rain are pouring down, the water bubble will quickly vanish and will not last longer. So true, Brahmins, human life is like a water bubble. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a line drawn on water with a stick will quickly vanish and will not last longer, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a line drawn on water with a stick. It is limited, etc., for none who are born can escape death. Right? So all of these are pretty, these are kind of making things kind of very, very clear, how fast things go by, how fast things disappear, how life suddenly has vanished, and there you are at the end. It's, you know, probably these are the kind of similes that are kind of the maximum kind of rate of change we could see perhaps even in those days. So again, all of these similes, the three first ones, are pretty much trying to say the same thing, that life often goes by so quickly, and when you realize that, you know there's no time to waste, and now is the time to act. Okay, next one. Just as a river flowing down from a mountain, going a long distance with a swift current, carrying along much flotsam, will not stand still for a moment, an instant, a second, but will rush on, swirl, and flow forward. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a mountain stream. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering and misery here. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. I like this. This particular simile is very nice because here he's obviously comparing human life to this mountain stream, a mountain stream coming down the mountain, very fast, very swift current, right? Running along, never stopping for a moment, as it says here. And this is like the life of many people. It is just like that. They move along, carry on, go from one thing to another one, ever restless, ever agitated, moving from here to there, craving, never really subsiding. In fact, not only that, but they identify with the doer. So many people identify with the doer in the world. And when they do, they feel alive, right? And because you feel alive when you do, you can never really rest because it goes against the very essence of your identity as a person. So this is problematic. So you carry on, you move on, right, from one thing to the next one, always feeling that you have this goal in mind, this aim, you're going somewhere, but the only place you're only going to one place, and that is to your grave, right? So what's the hurry of getting to your grave? Relax, that will all come in good time, no need to hurry to your grave. And this is kind of the feeling after a while you get, right? Where am I actually going? Not really going anywhere. The only place I'm going is to the cemetery. In those days, they had this wonderful charnel grounds where they would burn the body on a charnel ground, which I think would also remind you of death in a good way. These things, everything happened behind closed doors, right? You don't see life and death anymore quite in the same way, except if you go to, I don't know how in Sri Lanka, but if you go to places like India sometimes, you can see life and death much more clearly, especially in the poor parts of India, which is one of the fascinating things about India, what I really liked about it. You really get life in your face. You see what life is like. If you go to very wealthy countries like Australia, I don't see anything. Everything just happened behind closed doors. It's as if there is no death. All of these things are kind of hidden away for you. So remember these things much more when it is much more in your face. And this is what life is like, hurrying along, carrying along, much flotsam, right? As you hurry along in life, there are casualties on the way. Casualties because of all the craving you do silly things, and these also get carried along with the same stream as you hurry on towards your grave. These other beings also get trapped in the same problem, and that is kind of the flotsam, the casualties, the collateral damage of your life, right? Which is the problem there. It's a nice simile because I think it really says a lot about perhaps modern life in particular. You know, the connected life, always moving, always doing stuff, never really still, never really enjoying the peace of silence and stillness. Okay. Just as a strong man might form a lump of spittle at the tip of his tongue and spit it out without difficulty, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a lump of spittle. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Human life is like a lump of spittle. There you are, that's kind of... So, It's good, right? It really kind of, whoa, okay, that's really really powerful stuff. I should say, by the way, that they use the word Brahmins there, right? Brahmins here in this context does not mean that he's talking to a group of Brahmins like the Brahmanical caste or anything like that. Brahmins here is just the word for the monks. He's talking to the monks and he's calling them Brahmins because they are good monks, right? They are good kind of practitioners. They're practicing the right way. So they are given the honorary title Brahmin, not the Brahmin caste, but the honorary title, like somebody who is high, somebody who is elevated, and that's why he uses that word. And the Buddha also uses the word Brahmin in the suttas. He uses that to call the monks. For example, if somebody is an arahant, he will often call that person a Brahmin, right? A spiritual Brahmin, not the Brahmin by birth, but a spiritual Brahmin, a Brahmin by action, a Brahmin by qualities, rather than a Brahmin by birth. So this is one of the things that Buddha does in the suttas. He uses the vocabulary that existed at the time in India, and he takes it into his own teachings, and he gives it new meanings, like the word Brahmin, like the word Arahant, also a word that existed in India at the time. Tathagata, right? All of these words were already existent. Jhana, he gave it also new meaning. Next one, okay, let's go on to the next one. Just as a piece of meat thrown into an iron pan, heated all day, we quickly vanish and will not last long. So too, Brahmins, human life is like this piece of meat. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. That's quite literally true, right? Human life is like a piece of meat. That's pretty, very, very realistic in many ways. The last one. Just as when a cow to be slaughtered is being lent to the slaughterhouse, whatever leg she lifts, she is close to slaughter, close to death. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a cow doomed to slaughter. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. You're like a cow doomed to slaughter, right? Every breath you take, you're one breath closer to death. You have to be careful with that sort of perception, because you might feel desperate if you take that too literally. But that is basically the idea, right? Every step the cow takes, one step closer to death, is always in the vicinity, not very far away. The slaughterhouse is there. The slaughterhouse, of course, is the nature of the human being to die. A very powerful simile. I really like the last one. It kind of, again, it's one of those that drives home the point of what actually is happening, what life is all about. And then comes the kind of the crux of the teaching, comes at the very end here. And this is kind of the reason, I think, one of the reasons the Buddha taught this is precisely for this last paragraph here. But at that time, because the human lifespan was 60,000 years, the girls were marriageable at the age of 500. At that time, people had but six afflictions, six sufferings: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. Though people had such long lifespans and lived so long, and though their afflictions were so few, still the teacher Araka gave his disciples such a teaching: Brahmins, short is the life of human beings. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering and misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life. For none who are born can escape death. Right, so that was when it was 60,000 years. And now these days, as the Buddha goes on to say, I have elided that part of the discourse, but of course he says, well, these days, if you're lucky, you get to 100 years, and these days people have many more afflictions, all kind of terrible illnesses and things. But even then, even with this, at these lifespans, still life seems short, things just pass by. I think even if you go to the Devaloka, you get reborn in a jhana realm, you hang out there for a few eons, right, just enjoying yourself, and suddenly comes to an end. When it comes to an end, I'm sure even that also seems short. Because whenever something ends, when it looks back, it all looks like a dream, a fantasy almost. It's finished. Now you're moving on to a new reality. It is this new reality which is your present thing. So the past always seems quick and fast, as if it has just disappeared. So this is the problem. So always the idea of use the time while you have it now. Whatever bhikkhus should be done by a compassionate teacher, out of compassion for his disciples, seeking their welfare, that I have done for you. There are these feet of trees, there are these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus, do not be heedless. Do not have cause to regret it later. This is our instruction to you. And this is a standard phrase the Buddha always says at the end of a large number of suttas. I have compassion for you, and I have done what a compassionate teacher should do, seeking their welfare. In other words, his job is to teach. His job is to show the way. His job, he cannot actually do the practice for us. Once he has done that, then it is our duty to kind of get on with the business and seek out, right, the feet of trees or the root of trees and the empty huts. That's where meditation happens at the end of the day. The real meditation happens in solitude. You will see at all the suttas that deal with meditation, samadhi practice in particular, it always starts off by saying you go to an empty hut or to the foot of a tree, and that's where you meditate. So meditate, bhikkhus. Do not be heedless. Heedless, pamada. So be, you know what you're doing. Reflect carefully here. Don't mess around. This is your chance. Otherwise, you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. Of course, one of those things that, you know, what is one of the things that is our duty is precisely to heed the instructions of a teacher. And one of those interesting things that you see in places like the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when the Buddha is just about to pass away, there's this rain of flowers, according to that sutta, from the heavenly realm, all this rain of flowers and this music and all of these things happening. Exactly what is going on, I'm not sure, but obviously people were worshipping the Buddha. They were coming to pay respect to him and say their goodbyes. And then there was one monk who didn't come, right? And the monks were saying, oh, this monk, master, he's just sitting in the forest. He's not coming to pay respect to you. And then the Buddha gives this beautiful reply that it is not by coming here and bowing down to me and honoring me and worshipping me. This is not how you pay respect to the Buddha. The real way of paying respect to the Buddha is to do the practice, to actually attain the results. That is when a teacher is really happy with you. And this is so important to remember, you know, we are not, it is not by kind of doing Buddha pujas and all of these kind of things. That can be nice, it can be a supporting thing in our practice, if we do it to a small extent, to support kind of the positive emotions and to use our faith to enhance those positive emotions. If we do that, it's wonderful. But remember, at the end of the day, you have to actually do the practice. And when you get good results, and the teachers are so happy with that, they feel that they have succeeded. Remember, they want your best. They have compassion for us. They want us to have success. They want us to get out of suffering. That's why they are teaching. They're not teaching for themselves. They're only teaching out of compassion. So if they see that you are taking the teaching seriously, and you're actually getting yourself out of suffering, only then has their teaching actually succeeded. And for that reason, when they see us making the effort, getting the results, wow, they feel so happy. I can see that in Bodhinyana Monastery, that whenever some monk has success in meditation practice, you know, then Ajahn Brahm is very happy with that, because this is what he teaches for. This is the only reason he teaches. Otherwise, he would go to a cave by himself and just meditate all day. Because he doesn't really need all the teaching. In fact, I think sometimes he's had plenty enough of all the teaching that he does, because his meditation is very profound. So he would rather prefer just to stay somewhere by himself. And that's why you can see he's very, very happy when somebody gets some very profound meditation experience. So this should be our job, and this is the way we can also honor our teacher in turn. So remember that. This is one additional motivation to practice, right? How can we make our teacher happy? How can we honor them in the right way? How can we worship them, if you like, or respect them in the right way? Actually, by following their example, following their word, then they will be happy with us. Then they will feel the teachings were actually worthwhile. So that is the little story of Araka, which I find, I don't know, I always, when I read this story the first time, I thought, wow, that's a really neat story, this story of Araka, precisely because it drives home that point so well, the idea of impermanence and the shortness of things. Now I want to move on to the Ratta Pala Sutta. And this is found in the Majjhima Nikaya number 82. This is another very nice sutta, which has a nice summary of the Dhamma in it. And it's also nice because of the story which kind of is the framing narrative for the actual Dhamma content. It's very, very beautiful story of Ratapala. And I haven't included it here, but I will give you a quick summary. It's too long to read, but I will give you a quick summary of the story of Ratapala. Many of you will know the story already, but still, it's nice. For those of you who haven't heard it, it's a nice little story here. And this is the story of this young man called Ratapala, who lived in the village in the Kuru country in the north of India, on the kind of outskirts of where the Buddha would wander. And then one day the Buddha would come to the town where Ratapala was living. And then the Buddha gave this discourse. Ratapala was sitting in the audience, right? And while he was listening to the discourse, he thought, this is it, I have to ordain. This is what I want to do. This is obviously the right thing to do with my life. And later on, in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's the discourses of the leading disciples in various areas. And Ratapala was the leading disciple in faith, number one disciple in faith. He had one discourse, and straight away he knew, this is what I want to do here. So he had very strong faith from the very beginning here. So then after the discourse with the Buddha, he goes up to the Buddha and says, Master, I would like to ordain. And the Buddha replies, have you got the permission of your parents? This is one of the requirements according to the monastic Vinaya. Your parents have to agree to your ordination here. So Ratapala says no, and the Buddha says, well, you have to get your permission first of all from your mother and father here. So Ratapala says, okay, I will see to it that I get permission from my mother and father. Right? He's very determined. I will see to it that I get this. So he goes back to his parents' house and he says, Mother and father, please allow me to go forth. Now this is in India, he was the only son of the family. So his parents say, Dear Ratapala, you are our only son. How can we allow you to go forth? There's absolutely no way that we can allow you to go forth. Even if you were to die, we would lose you with great regret. So how on earth could we allow you to go forth? And Ratapala replies, well, if that's the case, I will lie down on the floor right here, and either you will allow me to go forth, or I will die right here. Right? This is determination for you. This is why he became the leading disciple in faith. And so he lies down on the ground, and the days pass, right? 5 days, 6 days, 7 days, and he's getting thinner and thinner. He's lying on exactly the same place on the ground. And then his parents are starting to get concerned. He obviously is very serious about this. So they plead with him, and eventually they get their friends to come there, and the friends talk to him. And he's able to convince his friends that there's no way that he's going to get up from there without either dying or being allowed to go forth. So the friends go to the parents and says, well, if you allow him to go forth, at least you will be able to see him afterwards. Because sometimes he will come back and visit you. And if he doesn't enjoy the monastic life, what else can he do but come back here and become a layperson again? So his parents think about this, okay, it's very logical, right? Much better than that when he dies. Okay, we allow you to go forth. And then Ratapala goes forth and he goes to see the Buddha, gets some teachings, and he practices really hard. And it says in the sutta, in a short time, he becomes an arahant. So in the suttas, short time means 20 years maybe, right? Short time. So in a kind of samsaric perspective, it's very short. So then he becomes an arahant, and he thinks, oh, yeah, maybe I should go back and visit my parents. So he goes back to visit his parents. And his parents, they don't recognize him straight away, because 20 years or 12 years or whatever is a long time. But eventually they recognize him. And when they recognize him, they say, okay, please, can we invite you for a meal tomorrow? Because he's now a monk, he lives in the forest, and they invite him as a monk to come for a meal. And then in the night before the meal, what they do in the house, they pile up two large piles of gold, right? As high as a man, because it's a very wealthy family here, very, very rich. And in the middle between these two piles of gold, they put his old wife, right? His wife from before, she's there, all adorned up with lots of nice makeup in exactly the same way that he liked her when he was a layman. And then she put all this behind the screen, right, so he doesn't see it straight away. And then when Ratapala comes in the morning, they place him down, they take away the screen and show him all this gold and his wife and all of these things. And then Ratapala says to his father, he says, Father, I think actually he calls his father householder. He says, householder. If I called my father householder, I would be in serious trouble, I think. That doesn't work. But anyway, he calls his father householder, and he says, householder, if I were you, will you allow me to say what I would do with all this gold, if I were you? And his father says, speak, Ratapala. And then he says that, if I were you, father, I would take, householder, I would take all this gold, I would put them into large canvas sacks, I would load it onto the back of a cart, I would drive the cart into the middle of the river Ganges, and I would dump all the gold into the river Ganges. And his father is very upset, very unhappy with this idea. And at this point, I think it starts to dawn on his parents that something has happened. He has changed. He is no longer the same Ratapala. This is Ratapala the Arahant compared to Ratapala the householder. So this is how the Arahants look at things, right? They see these things of the world as attachments, as problematic, things you have to look after, things you have to safeguard. And because that, it's all a headache. So who on earth wants all this gold? Much better to get rid of it and chuck it in the river Ganges instead. So his father is not very happy. And then as the conversation progresses, at one stage he calls his old wife. His old wife says something to him. And he responds to saying, sister, to her. And when he says sister to his wife, she faints, right? It's really kind of very sweet, the whole thing. She faints. And eventually everybody realizes there's no way that Ratapala is going to come back to the household life. So then, after this whole scene, then Ratapala kind of withdraws. He goes into the forest, and he sits down for the days abiding in the forest. The days abiding is just the meditation practice of a monastic at that time. And this forest happens to belong to a local king. So this story now begins where Ratapala is about to meet this king, and the conversation between the king and Ratapala is what the last half of the sutta is about. And this is the interesting part, because this is where the real Dhamma content actually is. So let's have a look at that remainder of the Ratapala Sutta. Okay. Then King Kauravya addressed his gamekeeper thus, good gamekeeper, tidy up the Migachira garden so that we may go to the pleasure garden to see a pleasing spot. Yes, sire, he replied. Now, while he was tidying up the Migachira garden, the gamekeeper saw the venerable Ratapala seated at the foot of a tree for the day's abiding. When he saw him, he went to King Kauravya and told him, sire, the Migachira garden has been tidied up. The clansman Ratapala is there, the son of the leading clan in this same Tulakotita, of whom you have always spoken highly. He is seated at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. Then, good gamekeeper, enough of the pleasure garden for today. Now we shall go and pay respect to that master Ratapala. Then, saying, give away all the food that has been prepared there, King Kauravya had a number of state carriages prepared, and mounting one of them, accompanied by the other carriages, he drove out from Tulakotita with a full pomp of royalty to see the venerable Ratapala. He drove thus as far as the road was possible for carriages, and then he dismounted from his carriage and went forward on foot with the following of the most eminent officials to where the venerable Ratapala was. He exchanged greetings with the venerable Ratapala, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood to one side and said, here is an elephant rug. Let Master Ratapala be seated on it. There is no need, great king. Sit down. I am sitting on my own mat. Sitting on elephant rugs is not allowable according to the Vinaya. So this is probably why he refused it here. There's probably some connection here to the Vinaya. Anyway, King Kauravya sat down on a seat made ready and said, Master Ratapala, there are these four kinds of loss. because they have undergone these four kinds of laws. Some people here shave off their hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, should be the ochre robe or the brown robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. What are the four? They are loss through old age, loss through sickness, loss of wealth, and loss of relatives. What is loss through old age? Here, Master Atapala, someone is old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage. He considers thus, I am old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage. It is no longer easy for me to acquire unacquired wealth, or to augment wealth already acquired. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Because he has undergone that loss through old age, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss through old age. But Master Atapala is now still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life. Master Atapala has not undergone any loss through old age. What has he known, or seen, or heard, that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? So this, what you're seeing here is some of the traditions in ancient India, where life was divided into four stages, right? One was a kind of growing up stage, one was the householder stage, one was a stage of learning Dhamma, and I'm not entirely sure, but something like that. And the final stage is a stage when you go forth, right? You leave the home life, and you lead a spiritual life in the last stage of life. And the reason for that, obviously, is because in the last stage of life, there is nothing else you can do, really. You can't really enjoy life in the same way. Things are kind of falling apart for you. So because of that, then, that is a time when people went forth. And you can see here, the motivation for going forth is not all that noble, right? It's not very noble motivation. Yeah, I can't make any money now. I can't really, everything is kind of, you know, not so interesting anymore in lay life. And because of that, that's why you go forth. It's not a very noble motivation. And this is why the king is so puzzled, because he realized that most people, when they go forth, the motivation is not so noble. But here is this young man, Ratapala. He was young, he was wealthy, he had everything in life, and still he goes forth. What is going on here? What has he known? What has he seen? What has he heard that actually enables that to be possible, that somebody who has everything still decides to go forth? And this is kind of one of these recurring themes in the Dhamma. It doesn't matter what you have in life. It doesn't matter if you are the king himself. Going forth is still far superior to any ordinary life, because the happiness, because the contentment, because the things you can attain with a spiritual life well lived are so far superior to any kind of ordinary life. And that, of course, is the point that is being made here. Okay. And what is loss through sickness? Here, Master Atapala, someone is afflicted, suffering and ill. He considers thus, I am afflicted, suffering and ill. It is no longer easy for me to acquire unacquired wealth, etc. So perhaps I should go into homelessness. Because he has undergone that loss through sickness, he goes forth from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss through sickness. But Master Atapala now is free from illness and affliction. He possesses a good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, but medium. Master Atapala has not undergone any loss through sickness. What has he known, or seen, or heard, that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? So there is another slightly dodgy reason for going forth, right? You're really ill, things aren't very well, your body is falling apart, okay, can't really enjoy the home life anymore, so I might as well go forth. One of the interesting things at the time of the Buddha, you read some of the Vinaya stories, and one of the Vinaya stories is the stories of Jivaka, the Buddha's doctor. And when the people heard that Jivaka had become the doctor for the Sangha, he was a very famous doctor at that time in Magadha. He had studied at Takasila, the famous university at that time, or maybe sometime after the Buddha, I'm not sure. Doesn't matter. He was very famous, and when the ordinary people heard, oh, Jivaka is now looking after the Sangha, they decided to ordain so they could get Jivaka for the doctor. Right? This is kind of some of the motivation that sometimes drove people to ordain at that time. Because obviously, in those days, life was sometimes very, very hard, especially if you were a poor person. Another reason why people would ordain was, oh, it's so hard to work for a living, right? And what I can do instead, just kind of hang out in robes, you know, go pindabat, receive food, and just sit at the foot of a tree all day and just chill. And that was kind of one of the other reasons. And these are all documented in the Vinaya, so it's quite interesting. And of course, all of those things are very, not only not noble, they are literally ignoble ways, or reasons, motivations for going forth. Okay. And what is loss of wealth? Here, Master Ratapala, someone is rich, of great wealth, of great possessions. Gradually his wealth dwindles away. He considers thus, formerly I was rich, of great wealth, of great possessions. Gradually my wealth has dwindled away. It is no longer easy for me to acquire unacquired wealth, etc., etc. Therefore, let me go forth into homelessness. Because he had undergone that loss of wealth, he goes forward from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss of wealth. But Master Ratapala is the son of the leading clan in this same Chulakotita, this town. Master Ratapala has not undergone any loss of wealth. What has he known, or seen, or heard, that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? And what is loss of relatives? Here, Master Ratapala, someone has many friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives. Gradually those relatives of his dwindle away. He considers thus, formerly I had many friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives. Gradually those relatives of mine have dwindled away. It is no longer easy for me to acquire unacquired wealth. Suppose I go forth into homelessness. Because he has undergone that loss of relatives, he goes forth from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss of relatives. But Master Ratapala has many friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, in this same Chulakotita. Master Ratapala has not undergone any loss of relatives. What has he known, or seen, or heard, that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? So this sets the stage for Ratapala now to actually teach this teaching that convinced him to go forth at that time, after the first meeting with the Buddha. And you see elsewhere in the sutra, as you see people saying that the Buddha has this conversion magic, right? He has this ability. Somebody comes from another sect, they go to the Buddha, and suddenly they convert. And there are a number of stories about that in the suttas. One of the classic ones is Upali. Upali, who was a Jain householder, followers of the Jains. And he went to see the Buddha, and then he decided to convert afterwards. It's quite a nice story, actually, the Upali Sutta. Number 56, I think, in the Majjhima Nikaya. So what is this conversion magic? What is it that makes the Buddha's teaching different from his other teachings? And this is, in a sense, what this King Kauravya is asking Ratapala about. And now Ratapala is going to give his reply to this question. Great King, there are these four summaries of the Dhamma that have been taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Knowing and seeing and hearing them, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. What are the four? Life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. This is the first summary of the Dhamma, taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Knowing and seeing and hearing this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Life in any world has no shelter and no protector. This is the second summary of the Dhamma, taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. Life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. This is the third summary of the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. Life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. This is the fourth summary of the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. Great King, these are the four summaries of the Dhamma that have been taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Knowing and seeing and hearing them, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. And then the King replies, or the King says, Master Ratapala said, life in any world is unstable, it is swept away. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? And Ratapala replies, what do you think, great king? When you were 20 or 25 years older, were you an expert rider of elephants, an expert horseman, an expert charioteer, an expert archer, an expert swordsman, strong in thighs and arms, sturdy, capable in battle? When I was 20 or 25 years old, Master Ratapala, I was an expert rider of elephants, etc., etc., strong in thighs and arms, sturdy, capable in battle. Sometimes I wonder if I had supernormal powers then. I do not see anyone who could equal me in strength. What do you think, great king? Are you now as strong in thighs and arms, as sturdy and as capable in battle? No, Master Ratapala, now I am old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stages. My years have turned 80. Sometimes I mean to put my foot here, and I put my foot somewhere else. Great King, it was on account of this that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, said, life in any world is unstable, it is swept away. And when I knew and saw and heard this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. So this is obviously about impermanence. The Pali word here for unstable is aduva, which is a synonym for anicca. You see it very often used together with anicca in the suttas. It means unstable, not permanent, not reliable, and all of these things. Sometimes it's useful to think about the word anicca in different ways. It is often translated as impermanent, but sometimes when you get used to these words, they don't really have any emotional impact anymore. So sometimes think about different ways of translating them. What do they actually mean? And one of the ways that I like to look at anicca is to see it as something which is unreliable, right? To me, the idea of unreliable, at least for me, this varies obviously from person to person. To me, unreliable has more of an emotional impact. Unreliable, like an unreliable friend, right, or whatever it is. And it's something which is kind of unsettling, something which you don't feel comfortable about if it's unreliable. So useful to sometimes think a little bit about these alternative translations of these things. So life is unreliable, it's out of control, right? You can't really have things your way. Nothing really goes the way we often doesn't go the way we'd like them to go. We have been looking at death, we have been looking at old age and illness, of course, and these things are part of this idea of unreliability. But of course, sometimes things are, even just in our ordinary life, things are often very unreliable. Very often we just don't know what is going to happen next. Sometimes we are surprised by the events of the world, or the events in our family, or the events in our own life. Suddenly things happen which kind of shock us, right? And that is because we haven't really taken on board fully this idea that things are always very, very unreliable, always so uncertain. Anytime somebody just, you know, nature is just waiting in a sense. Nature is waiting to ambush you with some kind of uncertainty, some kind of unreliability, something was going to shake you up and show you how dangerous it is to attach to anything in this world. And one way that I like to think about is that whenever you kind of take a stand somewhere, you can imagine yourself standing on a carpet. This is like, wow, I feel safe on this carpet, I can stand here. And then you think that you can attach to that, you can take it up. This is a safe place to attach to. As soon as you attach, as soon as you think you have a place you can stand, a place of safety, nature is going to come, snatch that carpet from under your legs, and you're going to lose your balance as a consequence. This is the way the world is, right? So unstable. It's like if you're standing on ground and an earthquake can come at any time and shake you up and you will lose your balance, you will fall over. There's nothing you can really grasp onto. There's nothing you can hold onto. There's nothing in the world you can attach to. As soon as you do that, you're asking for trouble and somebody's going to come and pull the carpet out from underneath your legs. And then, of course, you're going to have to get the suffering or whatever that comes from that. So this idea of anicca is very powerful and something we don't quite grasp. Very often we feel safe in our lives, right? We have our home, we have our society, and sometimes things feel so safe. It feels like society is quite stable, things are going in one direction. And then suddenly something comes and shakes up the whole order. And then you, whoa, what's going on? And you are shocked as a consequence. I don't know if you have caught recently, about a week ago now, the British voted to leave the EU. I don't know if you heard about that. And of course, everybody is in shock, right? Everybody, what is going on? What is going to happen? Is the whole EU going to break up? Are we going to go back to kind of the First World War and starting to fight with each other again, or whatever is going to happen? And this is, you can see, people are used to stability. They want things to be in a certain way. And suddenly when things change like that, wow, people are shocked. Even those people who voted to leave EU, apparently they were shocked as well. Everybody was shocked by the result. Right? So this is kind of the weird thing that happens. And it is good sometimes to remember that. These days our societies are often extremely complex. When things go wrong in a certain aspect, in a certain part of society, and it has repercussions throughout society, through all the layers. Technology is very complex, right? Something goes wrong somewhere in one place, and everything starts to collapse as a consequence. So everything is far more unreliable than we think. And we tend to hold on to things. And when things change, wow, we are shocked. There is no reason to be shocked, because this is what we should really expect. So this is the idea that things are aduva. And that, of course, is only the superficial impermanence, only the superficial unreliability. The real unreliability is directly to be experienced in meditation practice, when you see the very makeup of who you are is unreliable. The very khandhas, your body, everything, all the aspects of your mind, all of that is equally unreliable. And of course, that is the real shake-up. All the other stuff is only the small stuff, that is the real shake-up when you see that. So this is what the Ratapala, he must have been very sharp, right? Very wise, a simple teaching, and he kind of grasped it straight away here. The world is swept away, right? Like this mountain stream, always rushing on. There's nowhere to stand. There's always, it's like a permanent earthshake. You can't hold on to anything, because otherwise it will just be swept away and changed by anicca, and then you will suffer the consequences. And then the king says, "It is wonderful, Master Ratapala, it is marvelous how well that has been expressed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Life in any world is unstable, unreliable, it is swept away. It is indeed so. Master Ratapala, there exists in this court elephant troops and cavalry and chariot troops and infantry, which will serve to subdue any threats to us. Now Master Ratapala has said, life in any world has no shelter and no protector. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? What do you think, Great King? Do you have a chronic ailment? I have a chronic wind ailment, Master Ratapala. Sometimes my friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, stand around me, thinking, now King Kauravya is about to die, now King Kauravya is about to die. What do you think, Great King? Can you command your friends and companions, your kinsmen and relatives, Come, my good friend and companions, my kinsmen and relatives, all of you present, share this painful feeling, so that I may feel less pain. Or do you have to feel that pain yourself, alone? I cannot command my friends and companions, my kinsmen and relatives, thus, Master Ratapala, I have to feel that pain alone. Great King, it was on account of this that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, said, life in any world has no shelter and no protector. And when I knew and saw and heard this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Right? There is no, you cannot shelter from this world, the nature of this world, in a set in a certain way. Anicca is there. Things will always change. Dukkha is an aspect of this world. You can't hide from these things. You can't hide from your karma and the results of that karma. And also, not only can't you hide from it, but there is nobody you can go to and say, please help me. I am desperate. There's no protector out there. Right, and this, of course, is one of the things that makes the Buddhist teaching so different from any other religion, is the idea that there is no real protector. There's no one to look after you. There's no creator God you can pray to and say, God, please help me. I am desperate. I'm suffering so much. I don't know how to lead my life properly. I'm just messing it up. Please help me out. And there is nothing anybody else can really do for you. In the end, you have to take responsibility here. I was discussing with somebody the other day at the interview time about whether it is a good idea to pray to gods, right? I understand that many people in Sri Lanka too, they pray to kind of the Hindu gods or whatever for favors and all that kind of things. But be very careful with that sort of thing, because these things are, you know, what the Buddha is saying, these things are not really able to protect you. They can't really do anything for you. And this is the problem. In the end, we have to take responsibility here. And for many people, that is scary. And because it is scary, we see that also in the Buddhist world, people often pray to the Buddha, right? Or they pray to the ancient Indian gods or whatever it is. But praying to the Buddha is gone. You can't pray to the Buddha. He died 2,500 years ago. He doesn't exist anymore. The best, only thing you can do is to follow his teachings. But it is actually very common around, I don't know about here in Sri Lanka, but in many other parts of the Buddhist world, it is very common to pray to the Buddha. And because it is this natural human tendency, we often feel weak, right? We feel our defilements are so strong. We're not able to be in charge of ourselves. So we pray to some higher authority to kind of help us out and guide our lives. And that is why it is scary when there is no protector there. For many people, it's frightening here. But actually, it is also very liberating here. Because as long as there is some kind of deity there, some kind of protector, somebody who is in charge of you, somebody who created the universe, somebody who has the final say, it means that you are not really independent. They have the final say. They kind of are going to decide in the end what's going to happen to you, right? And are we really willing to put our hands into some kind of deity we don't know anything about? Isn't that kind of scary in a sense? We don't know anything about this God. Are we sure this God has our good intentions in mind? Maybe not. Maybe it's a bad God, right? When I see some of these Hindu gods, it's enough to make you scared. Some of these Hindu, like Kali and these gods, right? With the blood-dripping fangs and these kind of things. It is enough to make you scared. How can you pray to a God like that? To me, it doesn't make any sense. You don't know what they're going to do to you, if they really exist or not. So this is the problem with praying to a God. You're praying to something. You're placing your life in the hands of something you don't know anything about. And quite likely, they're not there anyway. And if there is no God there, you're absolutely wasting your time, of course. So there's something very profound by moving your mind away from that idea of a creator God or any kind of God that can help you out. It's liberating. It's liberating to take responsibility for yourself. Okay, now I am going to make sure I take responsibility for my own life and live my life well. There's no kind of... It means that now you can create happiness. You can actually do something for yourself. If you live well, there's an opportunity to do something. And that opportunity may not be there if you believe in gods and this kind of things. So it is a very liberating thing, the Buddhist teachings, if you practice it well, if you do it in the right way. But for some people, it is also quite scary in a sense. So this is why he went forth, right? He realized, I have to take responsibility. I have to practice. I can't leave this in the hands of anyone else. And of course, the kind of ultimate way of taking responsibility is actually to become a monastic or a lay person who practices very well, but at least to take these teachings seriously. That is how you take that responsibility here. So that is the world. There is no protector. We have to take responsibility for ourselves. And then the king says, "It is wonderful, Master Ratapala. It is marvelous how well that has been expressed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Life in any world has no shelter and no protector. It is indeed so. Master Ratapala, there exists in this court abundant gold coins and bullion stored away in vaults and lofts. Now, Master Ratapala said, life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? What do you think, great king? You now enjoy yourself provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasures. But will you be able to have it of the life to come? Let me likewise enjoy myself provided and endowed with these same five cords, the five kinds, the five kinds of sensual pleasure. Or will others take over this property while you will have to pass on according to your actions? I cannot have it thus of my life to come, Master Ratapala. On the contrary, others will take this property, while I shall have to pass on according to my actions. Great King, it was an account of this that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, said, life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. And when I knew and saw and heard this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Life in any world has nothing of its own. This is the thing we were talking about this morning. When you contemplate death and you realize that everything is just borrowed goods. You have them for a while and then they go back to nature again. Or they go back to the next generation or whatever it is. But there's nothing in this world that actually belongs to you. Nothing you can take with you. And that also strikes at the very core of our sense of individuality. A very important part of the idea of having a sense of self is also having a sense of ownership, right? These khandhas, either they are ourselves, or if they aren't ourselves, at least we own these things. This is my body, right? Everybody thinks this is my body. You own that body. The mind might be you, but you own the body. So the sense of ownership is always there. As long as the sense is a sense of self, there will also be a sense of ownership. Because in a very important part of the sense of self is the activity, the doing, the controlling of things. We want to control the world so we can satisfy our cravings, satisfy the needs of the sense of self. So because of that, even this much goes against our conditioning, right? That actually, in the end, you don't own anything. You borrow things for a short while, you enjoy them for a short while, and eventually it all has to disappear. So it is actually quite profound in many ways, even these things. Even though on the surface it's easy to understand, it goes very deeply to the very core of what we take ourselves to be here. It is wonderful, Master Ratapala, it is marvelous how well that has been expressed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. It is indeed so. Now, Master Ratapala said, life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? What do you think, great king? Do you reign over the rich Kuru country? Yes, Master Ratapala, I do. What do you think, great king? Suppose a trustworthy and reliable man came to you from the east and said, please know, great king, that I have come from the east, and there I saw a large country powerful and rich, very populous and crowded with people. There are plenty of elephant troops there, plenty of cavalry, chariot troops and infantry here. There is plenty of ivory there, plenty of gold coins and bullion, both unworked and worked, and plenty of women for wives. With your present forces you can conquer it. Conquer it then, great king. What would you do? We would conquer it and reign over it, Master Atapala. What do you think, great king? Suppose a trustworthy and reliable man came to you from the west, from the north, from the south, from across the ocean, and said, "Please know, great king, that I have come to you from across the sea, and there I saw a large country, powerful and rich. Conquer it then, great king." What would you do? We would conquer it too, and reign over it, Master Ratapala. Great king, it was on account of this that the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, said, "Life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. And when I knew and saw and heard this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness." So there you are. This is one of the things I have talked about quite a lot already. The idea that craving leaves the sense of incompleteness inside of us, being insatiate, never satisfied, never content with the present moment, always moving on towards something else, right? This is a classic example. Here is a person who is obviously very rich and very powerful already, but if he can become more rich and more powerful, he will take every opportunity, conquering one country after the other. And no doubt, if he had the whole earth, still wouldn't be enough, right? And then you want Mars and Venus and etc., etc. Keep on expanding forever. There is no end. Craving can never be satisfied in that way. It's a hole in our psychology. There's a hole inside of us. There is something missing. We feel incomplete inside. And it is impossible to fill up that psychological incompleteness by external objects. You can keep on amassing cars and relationships forever, but if there is a psychological problem, a sense of psychological lack, it will never be satisfied by external things. And for that reason, you can go on forever. You can, you know, it doesn't matter how much you have. That's absolutely irrelevant, because the cause of the problem lies in a very different place. It lies in your psychology. And that is why when the Buddha comes around and he says that's why his teachings make such good sense. Instead of looking outside to satisfy the emptiness inside, the hollowness inside, we have to actually look inside instead. And we have to build up those factors that give rise to real mental, real personal satisfaction. The kindness, the goodness, the generosity. And based on that, then build up the meditation practice until one day you find this feeling of being satisfied for the first time. No more craving, just pure happiness inside of you. Don't want to do anything else. And you feel for the first time, as I said many times now, that you have actually found the meaning of life itself. You found the answer to this question that everyone is searching for. What is really the meaning of life? Wow, how beautiful that is. So very nice here that you are a slave to craving, right? We think that we are in charge. We think that we choose to go out in the world and actually satisfy ourselves. It's exactly the other way around. We are the slaves to this force. We follow this force because we don't know any better. And that is a radically different way of understanding the world from how most people understand it. It is wonderful, Master Ratapala. It is marvelous a well that has been expressed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. It is indeed so. So, there you are. So those are just some nice Dhamma reflections to kind of summarize many of the themes we have been talking about. And then tomorrow we can have a look at the remainder of the suttas we have. In the meantime, please just continue having a nice time, and I'll see you again this evening at 7 o'clock.